On this episode of The Most High Show, we talk to my good friend, Dylan Jones. He's going to tell us a little bit about his story, his life, what it was like to be addicted to meth, and what it was like to find sobriety, find peace, and ultimately a connection with a higher power. All that and a little bit more on this episode of The Most High Show. Welcome to The Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is The Most High Show. But this is one of my favorite things to do, which is sharing stories, hearing people's stories, talking about someone's story. It's something I really enjoy to do. So, you know, you were asking me what's the structure like, and, you know, and so I have a structure in mind that kind of take people through. And what's cool is being a part of your journey for the last year and a half or so. I got to see a lot of it, and I've heard a lot of the story, but I think that there's so many things about your past, the things that you've been through as a child, and kind of what spurred you into living the life of drugs and alcohol and addiction. Mm-hmm. And so I'm excited that we can share that. And I know you shared your story with us probably early in, right? You were a few months into recovery.
Yeah, three or four months.
Yeah. And so you expressed to me, I really want to share my story again now that you have some time, you know.
Yeah.
So it's always interesting to me the first time someone shares a story, and I did the same thing. The very first time, we usually spend a lot of time in the darkness,
yeah,
all the drama. And then, you know, 15% of it is what we do to recover.
Yeah.
But today, your life isn't darkness and drama. So if you can just tell me, what's a day in the life of Dylan like?
Well, since I kind of let everything, all that darkness go, a lot of my life has turned into it's structured, you know. It's got a routine. I finally feel like I live a life of some kind of normalcy where I'm not just a normal person. I'm an addict that lives in recovery. I get up every morning, I go to work, you know, I spend most of my day at work, and I get, you know, a lot of my energy out there. And then usually within the evening, after I get off work, I do something recovery-based just to remind myself, you know, don't get out of the bounds of knowing you're an addict. You know, I got to remind myself daily. And so either I'll join a meeting, or I might do a big book study with my sponsor, or, you know, just, you know, read the Bible, anything like that. So, and then I got a couple hobbies. I might pick up the guitar, or I might, you know, play around on the computer for a little while, chit-chat with some of the guys at the Sober Living House, and, you know, rest my head and go to bed, say my prayers, and the next day I get up and do it again.
Yeah. So there's some predictability. There's some, you say you're not normal, but there's some normalcy in your life today. What do you think in this normalcy, right? Like, someone hears that, right? And someone who isn't familiar with the life of recovery or the life of an addict, that sounds like what everybody does. Everyone gets up, goes to work. Aside from the self-work after, you know, aside from journeying inward, reading recovery literature, reading scripture, praying, when you say chit-chat, what you really mean is you're talking more about just the day. You might be talking about the day, but you're also having deep, connected conversations with other men in recovery who are looking for the same thing you are,
yeah,
right? How different is that from what life was like 2 years ago?
Well, so I tell you this, when I first got to the recovery house, you know, I was very naive to recovery. I had no idea what I was getting into. It was all, I was just, you know, kind of self-driven there for a minute before I knew what I was, you know, trying to figure out.
What do you mean you were self-driven there?
Well, before I found my faith with God, I was self-driven in my recovery, where I felt like was what was going to make me sober and get through a program. And so I was self-driven and, like I said, naive. I didn't really have a clue. Looking back now, I know that I didn't have a clue. And I would just really just try to be as friendly as I could with all the people in the house and stick it out. I was trying to stick it out in recovery, not knowing if it was going to be a forever thing. But
right.
Eventually my goals transformed into something that I feel confident could be a forever thing as long as I treat it like it's a forever thing. With being able to come home now, I get to talk to the guys and actually be selfless in making an impact or giving myself of service to somebody or to the organization or anything like that, just to get, just to help somebody else, because I know what was given to me so freely that I feel like I should be giving it away daily so that I can keep it.
Yeah, that's good. That's some good principles to have. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, normal people, earthers, as I like to call them, you know, there's a certain dependency that we as addicts have on a higher power and on our community, you know. We need those real conversations. We need that prayer. We need a growing prayer life. We need a growing connection to a higher power. Because if we don't have these things, it's really easy for us to get complacent. And you know, speaking for myself, when I get complacent, that's when I get froggy, you know, and I'm looking at, how do I change? This is too easy, you know? So I'm always having to challenge myself on some level, whether it's spiritually, whether it's mentally, learning new things, reading multiple books, always in communication with other addicts and alcoholics, because those things are so key to me staying sober. Yeah. So, but I want, let's go back. Let's go back in time. Let's go way back.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about, like, for you as a kid, what are some of the memories you have as a child as it pertains to this story of you recovering and finding a connection to God?
You know, as a kid, I got to, I was raised by my mother, and she was pretty much a kid herself, trying to figure out her life while I was growing up. I got to watch my mom grow into an adult while I was, you know, from the time I was a baby all the way up till, you know, as of recent, you know, we're, and so a lot of things were on a shaky foundation for me when I was a kid. You know, we were either living with, you know, her parents, like her grandfather or her father, my grandfather, or, you know, we were always just, you know, here or there. And I remember I lived in Alabama for a year, and it was kind of all over the place and scattered. And then, you know, I didn't really have no solid foundation as a kid.
Yeah.
Moving forward into, like, when I was a teenager, I kind of got used to going to where I was at in middle school and then up through high school, and that was like the longest period of sustainability I had, where I was continuing to go to school, and that was living with my grandfather and my mother in Ball Ground, Georgia. So
your grandfather brought some stability in your life.
Yeah, he's always been there, and always been the person that my mom could go to, or I could go to. You know, he was always a really solid guy. But in the time that I was, like, you know, 17, 18, well, even 16 years old, I remember, you know, my grandpa, he had a house and I lived there, but he didn't chastise me for doing wrong. He didn't discipline me. It wasn't his job, you know. And at the time, my mother had moved to be with the man that she was pregnant with. And I told my mom, I said, I'm staying. I'm so used to going to school. I've got all my friends. I said, I'll just stay with my grandpa. And then at that time, I just kind of realized, hey, I don't have any authority because, you know, I could have friends over whenever I wanted to. I could turn the music up as loud as I wanted to. My grandpa would go to work at 10 in the morning after I was already at school. And then when I got home, he didn't come home until the wee hours of the morning because he stayed out hauling cars. So I would always have people over there. And then eventually the friends with, you know, the alcohol and the weed. And that evolved into drugs.
Yeah.
And then it continued all the way up until, you know, into my early 20s.
Yeah. Well, aside from the an instability that you felt, right, do you feel like there was anything internally missing inside of you that you felt like you were getting out of having the homies at the house, out of drinking? Was there something, a void or something that was being filled for you? What do you think that was?
Had to have been loneliness and lack of discipline. Just always trying to keep people around. I remember I'd always have to have a friend around. And when my friends weren't around or they didn't want to come to my house, I was always trying to figure out a way to leave and go be with some, just be around somebody. I felt like I was uncomfortable by myself.
Yeah.
And then just, I remember probably about when I was 23, I remember having this epiphany where I just got stressed out and overwhelmed. And I was like, man, I could be doing a lot better in my life. And if I would have just had more discipline when I was younger, or I would have had my family there. And I held resentments and stuff. I started building resentments against my mom and my dad, because I was just like, you know, damn, if y'all wouldn't have left me, I would have turned out way better.
Right.
So that was another thing that really, really hit me. And then, you know, just it got me into doing more and trying to fill that void and that pain. It got me into harder drugs.
But now, during the high school years, right, are you still maintaining like a good GPA? Are you getting to school? Are you just partying in the afternoons and on the weekends, or?
So I got caught with weed at high school and they sent me to an alternative school. Uh-huh. And, you know, I thought I was Billy Badass, right? You know, so I got sent to Crossroads Alternative School, and my motivation for going was my girlfriend. You know, so I was like, yeah, I was driven to get up and I was driven to go to school. And I had there again, that loneliness kicks in. I didn't want to be alone. So why not go to school while my friends are and my girlfriend's at? And then, you know, that was my motivation. I was really a smart kid. And a lot of my teachers would tell me, you know, I'm, you know, got a good head on my shoulders. But kind of like what you said, you get complacent. You got to continue to challenge yourself. That's the way I was. Where I would just goof off or get in trouble.
Well, did you feel like school was hard, or you were able to just?
I mean, it was still kind of hard with all of the things. Like I remember when I was like 16, 17 in high school, and I had a agenda, and my parents were supposed to sign off on it. Well, guess what? I mean, I had to bring it home every day. My grandpa wouldn't sign it. You know, and I didn't ever meet up with him to get him to sign it. So I would just forge him, you know. So that made it hard. But other than that.
Yeah. So you kind of like early on became kind of your own man in a way, right?
Yeah.
And then, but you were getting a lot of fulfillment out of that tribe of the people you were drinking and getting high with.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, like that crew. I mean, you know, as dysfunctional, and even in my life, right, as dysfunctional as my crew was growing up, they were still my crew.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like they would always, they'd be there if we were gonna get in a fight. They'd be there in the good times. They'd be there in the bad times. You know, they're always rolling with you.
Yeah.
Right. So there was like this kind of, there's a social aspect to addiction that sometimes, you know, the substance itself is almost like ancillary. It's secondary to the main, the real thing. The real thing is the connection everyone has.
Yeah.
And when everyone's on the same vibe or on the same high, it makes that connection even better.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that was my experience, you know. I mean, there's a lot of similarities in the way, you know, you kind of grew up and doing that. So in your 20s, you said that you experienced kind of a shift. Is that when it got darker for you? Is that when it stopped being just hanging out, having a good time?
Yeah, it got really dark. I would go, so I, when I started to get into my 20s, I started going to jail. I started getting in trouble. And I never got like felony charges, but I was doing things leading up to the misdemeanor charges that were considered felonies, of course. But, you know, I would always be getting in trouble for like driving without a license or just, you know, crazy small stuff. But leading up to that moment where I had that shift was I had gotten with a woman and we had conceived a child. And then, you know, maybe like a year or 2 years down the road after the child was already born, my daughter was already here and 1 year old, I remember working at a place called Pilex in Canton, and I was just working like this job for a staffing agency, and it wasn't really like, I remember I was using drugs and I would fall asleep trying to count these little metal pieces coming down the conveyor belt, and like, just got super stressed out and went outside, and I'm down on myself because I've got warrants. It's crazy that they even hired me because they knew I had warrants, but they're like, yeah, we'll still let you work because they did a background check and it was like misdemeanor warrants. But so I had warrants. I didn't have a license. It was going to cost a lot of money to get it back. I had a child. All of my money was not mine. I was working for money that was going to either, you know, my daughter or having to pay her grandmother some money so we could stay in the basement or I would blow money on drugs. And so then I definitely didn't have any money from that. And I just had this shift, and then it just got really, really dark. I did not feel, I felt so inadequate. At that time, to try and be a father and to try and take care of things I had to take care of, and I was
how
just.
How old were you at this time?
I was 24, and I was running really hard, not from just legal things, but I was running from everything, and I ended up quitting that job, and I started doing tattoos. Thought that was going to be my profession or whatever, so I would be like this little traveling tattoo artist and stuff. And I go, and people would hit me up, and it was usually like, you know, women that had drugs and stuff like that, and they were talking about they wanted a tattoo, but that was never the case, you know. And so I would leave my child and her mother in the middle of the night, and leave a text message on her phone and say, "Hey, I'm gonna go run a tattoo. I'll be back," and I'd stay gone for a week. And the drugs had got a hold of me, and I was just running. I had so many fears of what I felt like I was never gonna be. I was never gonna be a good dad. I was never gonna be a hardworking man. I was never gonna be nothing but a drug addict. And then when I had that realization,
that's when you turned it up. There was nothing holding you back at that point.
Yeah, I started using drugs intravenously, and and it got. It just got way out of control. Yeah. I started.
You're talking about meth.
Meth, yeah.
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 And
which is not, it's not like you using it and then kicking it on the couch for
no.
a couple hours.
I was
you
using
get high
it.
And you go and do a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, and I was you know, kicking in doors and like, you know, like robbing people, stealing from people, hurting people, mistreating women, and it was all. It wasn't. You know, most people say, yeah, well, when you get on that meth, you're crazy. You start acting crazy. I don't. Most of the reasons why I was doing that is because I was hopeless and I had nothing to live for at that time.
Wow.
And
yeah.
I was telling you, from an early age, I felt like I was by myself. And then, you know, moving into, and I don't have any other way to say it. Like, you know, maybe I wasn't by myself, or maybe I had everything I ever needed. It was just what I chose to do with it. But
well, you saw your life as hopeless.
Yeah.
You saw it as going nowhere, and that was the reality you believed.
Yeah.
And so you just held on to that reality.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, and I got sick in the head from continuously using the drugs and warping reality in my mind to fit what I thought it was.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, I was gonna die that way. That's the way I thought, and I wasn't gonna live to be in my 60s, 70s, 80s. My motto become live fast and die young. And so I could do that while I was using speed. And the more I use it, I would eventually end up there, you know? That was, yeah. was my mentality at the time.
Yeah, you'd given up. Mm-hmm. Wow.
At the age of 24, I'd completely give up.
Yeah. Now, by God's grace, you know, life didn't give up on you, right? We're doing the show Recovery Rundown, and James has a story in there about meth addiction and how it's like 40,000 people a year die from meth overdose or meth related causes.
Yeah,
like, you know, that's a lot of people.
Yeah,
and meth is becoming more and more like widely used, and more people are overdosing from it. Everybody talks about the opioid epidemic, and that's because it's being talked about, right? But meth is a, you know, I did meth in my high school years, and I'm glad I did my meth young, you know, because once I got off it, I was like, I'm not going back. I went back to other things. But yeah, meth will take you to a dark place. And if you're already in a place of hopelessness and despair, right, the meth is just reinforcing all of those things, right? So when do you get to a point during those years when you've given up hope? Do you get to a point where you start feeling like for most of us, like, there's a point when we begin to go, I don't want to live this way. Did you get to that point at all?
Yeah.
Do you remember what it was like at that moment?
Yeah. I can tell you the first time that I experienced that and what that felt like. When I was, you know, 24, 25, you know, I was still running the streets and doing it, and everything was real dark. And I finally caught my first felony meth charge. Mm. And it was in just the worst way that it could have happened. I was in such a dark place. I used to think that when I'd have blood running down my arm, I thought that was just cool to look like that. And I used to ride around with this chick that, you know, she was, you know, buying dope, selling dope. We would just ride around. We thought we were hot shit, but we was getting rides from people.
Y'all thought you were balling. The reality is you just jumping in other people's.
Well, we'd have like, you know, an ounce or two of dope and some weed and everything, and then we need a ride. We'll pay you in meth for a ride.
Right.
But end up getting pulled over in Holly Springs, and it was because the kid that was giving us a ride had a headlight out, and we didn't even think that. Ask or check the vehicle before we left, so whatever. And anyways, I ended up in jail.
Yeah, it's not a meth thing to do. You know, when you're out running the streets getting high, you're not like, let's make sure you don't have any violations on your vehicle. Is your tag up to date? Is your insurance caught up? Like, no one's asking those questions.
No.
You just on to the next one.
Yeah, and
headlights out, you get pulled over.
Yeah, I get pulled over, and I had like some pot on me, a lot, and a lot of meth too. So ended up, the cop come up to the car, did not look like a good, you know, situation was going on. And he smelled the pot for sure. And the girl I was with, I tried to give her the meth, and she said she was going to hide it or whatever. And we get to getting pulled out of the car and everything. I've already handed them the weed because I knew they smelled it. So I was going to take a misdemeanor charge on the weed. And then she ended up dropping all the meth in the floorboard and everything like that. And they charged me and only me with it. Because the other two kids that were in the front, they were like 18, 19. And, I just told them, I said, it's mine. It's like, you know, and she didn't even get charged for it. She had a VOP for felony probation. She went to jail, too. So I ended up in jail. And then after maybe a couple of days in there of losing my mind, because I'm in there trying to call people to come get me out. And I would get so mad. I was beating the phones with the phone. And they put me in the hole.
Yeah.
And I'm totally alone. The one thing that I hated the most. And I ended up calling my child's mother, and I was talking to her saying, hey, I'll do anything. I'll give you the money back. And I didn't have any money. I was trying to lie then, manipulate then. I just need to get out of here. She's like, no, you really need to just sit. She was like, you've really burnt your bridge. And by that time, I realized I didn't want to be like that anymore.
And you had that space because you're locked up, so you weren't getting high.
Yeah.
So you're coming down in jail, right?
Yeah.
And then you're in isolation, forced to face yourself.
Yeah.
Really? So when you say you didn't want to be like that, what do you mean you didn't want to be like what?
I didn't want to be sick anymore or suffering from the symptoms of my illness as bad as I was. I didn't want to be a deadbeat dad. I didn't want to be addicted to drugs anymore. I didn't want this bondage, this fleshly bondage, earthly bondage that I was consumed by. I couldn't handle it anymore. I wanted to be a guy that people could rely on, and, you know. But so.
Now, do you feel like you got, you know, I don't get weird, like a vision, right? But do you feel like you were given a version of you? Did you see a version of you that wasn't that way? Or was it just the pain of all the consequences that made you go, okay, I can't be here no more? Or do you feel like you got some sort of idea of who you could be?
I had no idea who I could be.
Yeah.
I could. Right now, I have no idea who I could be.
Yeah.
I think that it was just from the pain of the consequence, pain of regret.
Yeah.
I had, you know, I had to learn everything the hard way, you know. With lack of discipline that I had growing up, everything became the hard way. And even when somebody would tell me, hey, you know, I didn't care for authority. I didn't have any authority. And if you tried to tell me what I was supposed to do, I'd just go home. Because guess what? There wasn't nobody who'd tell me what to do.
Yeah.
So you're sitting in jail. You've been left there.
Yeah. And so I eventually get with my attorney and get out after like 30 days. And they put me on this probation where I forgot exactly what it's called, but I have more stipulations of probation to complete and a shorter time period of probation. Usually that's a 5-year charge. They give me 3 years of probation with a bunch of stuff to do in it. I got out of jail, tried to go back to my child's mother. That didn't work. She didn't want nothing to do with me. And
I wonder why.
Yeah, wonder why I burnt that bridge. So
right.
Then I go back and I'm running around the streets and I'm using drugs again.
Was that a hard decision to get back into it, or was it pretty?
It was for her. It was.
I'm saying for you to get back into drugs, was that?
Oh no, I was right hopeless again when she rejected me. I was hopeless again, and I had no structure, no idea of what. Right. What to do with recovery. So I got right back in the drugs.
Right.
Just as hard.
Yeah, because the rejection And it's like, you know, you think because you've made the right decision and you're trying to do the right thing. Now, and everyone's not clapping and blowing streamers and singing your praise because Dylan finally made a good decision.
Well, I'd ultimately made a super bad decision because I went from not having any felonies, and those warrants that I had when I was working at that job or whatever, I eventually took care of them. But when I completely got freed up from that, then I started getting more into drugs. So a little bit of freedom and just me being sick with it, you know what I mean, kind of just drove me dark. But back where I was saying in the time where she rejected me and I got super hopeless, couldn't move back in, I started hanging out with the worst friends that I ever thought I could ever have. And, you know, it was just right back into the really, really dark place I was in. And I would run, and then I would hide, you know, and then eventually I got in contact with my mother, and she was like, I kind of didn't give her a choice. I said, I'm coming down to Ackworth. I said, I'm coming to stay down there. I was seeking refuge at my mother's house.
And by this time...
Because you had this case pending on you.
Yeah.
You had all this list of stuff you were supposed to do.
Yeah, so I fleed, and I'd stay down there, and...
Now, the release was contingent, so you weren't looking at another court date to do time. They released you in 30 days with this heavy probation.
Yeah. And I had, like I said, I got hopeless. She rejected me. I had no foundation to stand on, nothing I could do. So I was like, the only other option I got is to go to jail. But before I go to jail, they're going to have to catch me. Mm. So... Like I said, I went and I ran. I fled from Cherokee County, went down to like Bartow County, and I'm staying down there with my mom. And I didn't give her a choice whether or not I was going to stay or leave. And I picked up some other girl that was hanging out with me, and I was using her for rides and everything like that. And, you know, I was right back in it, and I thought I was, you know, I was still coming up to Cherokee County, even though I wasn't supposed to. I had warrants out. Oh, well, I had enough dope that says I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof to do it. And I eventually got caught again where I was driving this girl's car, and I fled from the police in Ball Ground, downtown Ball Ground, doing like 60 on a back road until I had nowhere to run. The cop pulled me out of the car and took me to jail. Violated my probation, and I ended up doing like 60 days or something, and then they let me back out. Mm. Yeah, because I was like, I got some really good people I can go stay with and all this stuff. And I ended up going and I got to live in Jasper and do probation up there after they let me out. And I eventually just didn't like, I was going to work every day, but I wasn't doing community service, wasn't making enough money to pay probation, and I eventually got fed up with that.
And also, you're not pursuing recovery.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're not looking for a deeper, more intimate connection with a higher power. You're not going to meetings or working any kind of program.
Nothing.
You're just basically... meeting the minimum requirement.
Yeah.
Right? To stay out of jail.
Yeah. I mean, I went to maybe one or two AA meetings.
Yeah.
And, I just didn't like it. And, because I felt like I had to be there instead of, you know.
Yeah.
So I got tired of trying to do it again. This is, you know, the second chance that they give me. And they stacked up even more stipulations. Like my community service went from 40 hours to 120 hours. And, you know, it just got even more stressful. But I had, you know, nothing that I felt like. I felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. And then I started drinking. Because I was like, you know, all right, well, where I'm living at, they're probably not going to be cool with me doing meth. So I'm going to go fishing, and I'm going to drink Captain Morgan's, the white rum, the spiced white rum or whatever. And I was just content with fishing. And then some of my old behavior come back, because then I started hitting up different girls and stuff, and was drinking and was hanging out with the wrong people. And then eventually I took some acid too. And then that warped my mind to think like, whoa, you know, I'm above the law. And I just had this crazy weird feeling after eating that stuff. And it wired me up, because I was up for hours, you know, I was up for like 24 hours straight just off a couple hits of acid. Mm-hmm. And that feeling of like wanting to get high off meth come back after I come down off that. So I got back with another friend and eventually realized I was causing problems where I was living then using drugs, so I had to leave. And I went and stayed at a house where everybody did drugs. And I could freely do my drugs, but I was still on the run from probation. And it was just, I got back in that dark place again. And then I met this girl who comes over there, and she wasn't getting high, but she was giving people rides to the store that needed to go to the store. And then I had a bunch of people coming to me wanting to do tattoos and stuff. And then I eventually just asked her, I said, hey, I said, do you want to go sell dope for a living? She said, no. I said, do you want to drive me around while I do it? And she said, maybe. So she liked me. She did not like what I did. Mm. And I got out of that house and went back to my mom's, went back down there, because I knew I could go do whatever I wanted. It's just when I left from down there, I would run the streets to get in trouble. And this is Savannah, the girl I'm with today, and she stuck it out with me for a while, and she remembers me sitting there saying, like, I hate this, I hate the way my life is, I want to change it. And, you know, and then I even come up with this plan. I was like, I'm going to have to go do some time in jail, and you'll have to stay out, and, you know, I just felt like if we went and did our time together, it would have been harder. But I was like, I need to go turn myself in. And while she was with me, she ended up getting a warrant for DUI and didn't want, you know. I was like, you just wait and I'll go do my time. I eventually got caught with meth again. And I wasn't around her when I got caught. Went back to jail and then signed up for the drug court program. And after 3 months, they let me out in the drug court. Well, 3 days down the road, I go back to my mom's, get all my stuff, go to Waleska, where her grandparents were, and then she's taking me to drug court, and we get pulled over in her car.
And she's got the warrant.
She got the warrant, goes to jail. Then she does 4 months, and during that time she was doing her time. That's when I had to have a place to go, and I had nothing, nowhere, nobody, but I had the will. I just didn't want to live like that anymore. And I had a lot of consequence over my head. So I went to Vision Warriors, where I had heard from a couple people in the drug court program. I went there and I was just like, what do I got to do to get in, you know? And I was hopeless. Even not having done drugs for 3 months and getting out of jail, I still felt hopeless, but I didn't want to ruin it this time.
Mm. And when you get released this time, you're in a program that's much more stringent than a probation with a list of requirements, right? Yeah. The drug court program was testing you regularly. I think they had requirements on you, right? You had to have housing, you had to have employment, you had to have X amount of things, right?
Yeah.
And they were checking up on all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a much a more stringent program for you to be a part of.
Yeah.
Right? And also it was an alternative to doing the time in prison.
Yeah.
Right? So you still have this sense of hopelessness, but because of the consequences and because of the pressure that's on you, your drugs aren't as easy of an option at this point to get high.
Right.
Right. Because there's some structure and some accountability in your life now, by way of the drug court system.
Yeah.
Right. And that's where you found not a lot of places up there for someone in that situation to go to find housing. You burned all your bridges, right? I'm just recapping.
Yeah.
Right. You burned all your bridges. You got nowhere to go, right? You can't go to Mom's because Mom's is, first off, out of county and not necessarily a safe place, right? Your ace, is she's locked up now.
Yeah.
So there's nowhere for you to go, right? Do you feel like that place now, looking back at that moment in time, do you see the grace of God in that?
Yeah, because I had to become open-minded, and I had to just had to like open myself up and just freely flow with whatever I had to do. I had to surrender at that moment in my life, because there's no way that whatever I ever tried to do was gonna work.
Yeah,
it never did. So I had to just go.
All your ideas was like a bag of meth and a ride somewhere. That's pretty much all the ideas that you had.
It's like if I had a bag of meth, like I had something to go do. And I would just show up places. But anyways,
right.
So.
Right. So you already, you're catching on to that your wisdom is not amounting to shit.
Yeah. And I was like, you know, I just didn't want to do it no more. And like, you know, drug court's not this like divine program, but you can find, you know, you can find God within anything if you look hard enough. But I just, like I said, I was naive in the beginning of all this, and I was self-driven. But in the same instance, I just had to go with the flow. Whatever drug court said, I had to do. So I first learned what surrendering was to a program, to an authority. I had to submit to an authority.
A power greater than yourself.
A power greater than myself.
Case, Cherokee County Court Drug Court System.
Yeah, and it was. And so, and then it got to be a good thing. It got to be great, because I was like, wow, if I just do what they say, my life is easier. It's easier to manage my life. And I was like, whoa, right? And so I do the drug court thing, and you know, I just kind of soared through it. I got through the first phase, and then I got through the second, to the third, and never really had any setbacks. I mean, I was moving through the program so fast, I barely had enough time to savor my victories. Mm-hmm. But as time goes on in that program, I end up learning things about myself.
Yeah.
And realizing, you know, like, it's okay to be alone. It's okay for me to have shame and guilt, and it's good, because then when I'm
forced to deal with it,
I have to deal with it, and then right. but even though I'm alone, I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Because at any point in time I could share it with somebody, or I could pray about it.
So drug court's giving you some tools to process your thinking, process your emotions, right? They're giving you some structure and accountability. You're living in transitional housing that's providing additional structure and accountability. But the relationship with God, is there a defining moment there that you recall when you feel like that really started to make a connection for you? Anywhere over this last year and a half that was like, you know, you acknowledge that, this is where God really intersected, or where you at least acknowledge that God was a part of your life.
Yeah, I want to say, to be 100% transparent, like the direct intervention of God, never really, I've known about it, but I never felt it until just the past couple months, where it really set in. I've been struggling at like work and stuff, and I said, you know what? I'm just gonna put it on the fish, and I'm gonna let it ride. I'm just gonna
put on the fish. This ain't like a drug term. this means you're going to put the radio on the station.
Yes.
Called Fish.
Yeah.
Somebody back there Googling, put it on the fish.
Put it on the fish.
Does my son put it on the fish?
So I put it up in my work truck, and, you know, I'm there 10 hours out of the day. So,
driving around,
and I'm
listening.
Like, and I said, yeah. And that's one little thing I changed. Because I'm trying to, through God, we get, I was trying to be delivered through anxiety. I had a lot of it built up. And then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to start reading a little bit of my Bible. And I'm going to start learning the Word and see. Because if you don't know the Word, it's harder to pinpoint where how God's working in your life. If you don't know how God works, then how are you going to know He's, you know, unless just some crazy instant miracle happens. But, you know.
So it's a gradual thing. You begin to start listening to different. You're listening to music that's glorifying God, right? Or at least that version of glorifying God. And then you're beginning to read Scripture on your own. Is there a Scripture that stood out to you? Is there something you read that really resonated with you?
Well, I know, like in Peter, where... Or like how in the Bible it says that Peter was on the boat with Andrew, and he was looking for, he thought he'd saw Jesus, and you know, he said that if you are God, command me to come out on the water, and Jesus, all he said was come.
Yeah.
And then it tells about how Peter got out on the water and he started walking towards Jesus, but as soon as the wind blew through, he started to sink, and just as the same, just like how every addict cries, and the addict's prayer is, God, save me. And that's exactly what Peter said to God. And so him stepping out of that boat was faith. But along the way, he got off balance, because when the wind blew, you know, He felt like...
He paid attention to the wind.
Yeah, he paid attention to the wind. He took his eyes off God, and he lost his faith for a little bit.
Yeah.
But he immediately come back and said, God, save me. And Jesus pulled him right up out of the water. And that's that just, you know, it sticks with me. Another one is...
Now, we'll slow down. Why does that stick with you?
Man, because I lose faith every day, and I have to re-surrender to God, because... I get my self, yeah. I'll be my self-driven ways will come back in, and I'll start being like I instead of going you, and you know, I have to you know, re-surrender every day, or I have to, you know, tell God, I need you, you know, I don't need me, I don't need to do what I want to do.
Yeah. You know, the thing that I love about that story, right, of Peter, is we always focus on Peter paying attention to the wind and fall and sinking, right? But he didn't sink right away. This is what's the most powerful thing about that story to me. Peter walked on water.
Yeah.
Jesus was walking on water, and he said, come. Peter got out the boat and walked on water. To me, that's the story.
Yeah.
He was walking on the water. And but he had his eyes fixed, right? His intention was set, you know? So, you know, Peter wasn't no joke, you know? He walked on water. If Peter could walk on water...
Yeah, with his eyes set on God, he was able to perform a miracle in himself. Yeah. And that's the story. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
And that's all. It's all about faith, man.
Listen and obey. But it's a day, like you said, a daily surrender. And so, you were gonna say there was another scripture that or story that you remember that,
yeah,
that really stuck out to you.
Matthew 6. You know, do not worry about your life.
Yeah.
Not for the things that you wear. You know, the things that you'll eat. Mm-hmm. He says, look at the birds of the earth, how they do not reap more so, nor gather into barns, which your heavenly Father still provides for them.
Yeah.
You know, for worrying, shall I add one cubit to your stature? what do you think God would do for you, O ye of little faith?
Right.
And to me, it's just like, man, I worry about some small stuff sometimes.
Mm.
And man, I don't ever have to worry about what I'm gonna eat, the clothes I wear, how my day's gonna turn out. I worry about how long the day's gonna be sometimes, or
right.
You know, stuff like that, or how things are. But that always stands out to me, cause I worry sometimes. I worry all the time, every day. But
well, I think that's part of the addict mind is, even though, you know, kind of taking it back, right? Like kind of full circle, like you had this instability at an early age. You had this fear of being alone. There's something innately spiritually disconnected within you, which is why you turn and why we all turn to those, to drugs and alcohol and the crew and the team and the party and the tribe that's participating in that, because we find that. It's just an artificial substitute for the real thing that's missing.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, the real thing that's missing is an intimate connection to God. That is the thing that's always been missing. I've just always tried to figure it, replace it with whatever, you know, if I could believe the right things, if I could use the right substances, or if I could take a little bit of this substance with this substance and then add a little here, then I'll be okay, right? But the real thing for me is an innate need to be connected to my higher power, right? And like, that's where you're still, as an addict, it's a gift that we have. Like, we have to have this connection with our higher power, because it's the thing, that's the very thing that we've been missing all along. And once you figure that out for yourself, nothing really, you know, compares, you know? And it sucks, but that's part of that overactive thinking, that brain that's going 100 miles an hour first thing. I don't know if your head does this, but when I wake up, I ain't even got to take my feet off the bed. My brain's going 100 miles an hour. And, you know, I think for a long time I judged myself for that. Why do I still have that, right? Like, I got some time. I should be better, you know? But I think that on some level I will always have to manage that, because at the core of who I am, I'm a person who needs some sort of connection, conscious contact with God on a continued basis. If I don't seek that out, then I get this check engine light in my brain, this warning light that says, hey, fool, you're not doing the thing you need to do, you know? I think I got halfway through today and realized, man, you know, I really didn't pray today.
Yeah.
You know?
I do that sometimes.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a lot. That's a lot of redemption. That's a lot of grace you've been given. You're in a place now where you're getting some foundation. You're getting some foothold. The realization that you can be alone. Your job right now has got you alone a lot of the day.
Yeah.
Right? And you seem to be managing that. I mean, you got some anxiety and some worry, but you're not jumping in a car with a bunch of dope anymore, right? Uh-huh. So what do you have to say to that person who might be on the other end of this, listening to you or watching you, and they're at that place where you were, where they didn't want to live like that anymore? They wanted to make a change. What can you tell that person?
I know before, whenever I did this, I said to never give up. That's such a vague thing to just say never give up. Never give up what? Never give up sticking a needle in your arm?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But for now, is if you want to make a change, if you are in that darkness like I was, and you want to make a change, but you haven't yet, it's because you ain't working hard enough, or you ain't trying hard enough. And there's resources out there, unlimited amount of resources nowadays for people that want to treat this as a disease, you know, addiction as a disease. And there is treatment. it's going to be a lot like having high blood pressure the rest of your life. You'll have to treat it daily for the rest of your life. But, you know, it's not impossible. And it's real easy to get close to God in recovery. You know, you're not just going to church and you're not an earther, man. If you're on drugs, it's going to be real easy for you to get close to God. He's got to give you a little more grace and mercy than he does the earth or the other people, you know?
Right. God loved the kids and the fools.
Yeah, so that's the thing. If you want out of that, don't wait on God. Don't wait on God. You better start serving God. And like I said, if you ain't already found it, if you ain't already, you got to step out on faith. A lot of what held me back was fear until I had to sit in jail and go through it. And it might be really hard to go through a little detox period before you can go and step foot into a recovery zone and be sober and then deal with it like that. But if you want out of it bad enough, you got to, you ain't already there, you ain't trying hard enough in my book.
Yeah, you got to do the work.
But there is hope. You just got to have that faith.